Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast, where good taste... just play the sound effect. My name is Whitney Seibold. I'm a film critic. I contribute to Slash Film. With me, as always, is the far more scintillating and, this week, far better watched film critic. William, introduce yourself.
My name is William Bibbiani. Yes. I am a film critic. I write for The Wrap. And gosh darn it, everybody calls me Bibbs. And we're here to review some movie films. The best kind.
For theaters.
Ooh, well, some of them. This week, on Critically Acclaimed, we're reviewing the new releases, A Minecraft Movie. I appreciate how they're downplaying it.
It's not the Minecraft movie. It's just one of them.
Which is also very presumptuous.
If they make another, I'm sure they'll call it another Minecraft movie.
I mean, that would be funny. We're also going to be reviewing the biopic, The Luckiest Man in America. The latest public domain slasher movie, Screamboat.
Yeah, we did one last week, too, about Popeye.
This one is about Mickey Mouse. And then the co-directorial debut of Finn Wolfhard, a slasher comedy called Hell of a Summer. And here's the thing about Finn Wolfhard. He wolfs hard. He wolfs very hard.
He's one of the Stranger Kids.
I don't know him.
Or is
he might be Stranger
Kids. I mix up.
I think
those.
Many of them are the same kids.
There's a lot of crossover between those two.
I mean, it's at least a little, right?
Yeah.
I can't keep track of them. '80s horror guys.
Yeah. I did watch the first season of Stranger Things. Couldn't tell you a thing about it. Exited my brain pretty quickly.
Yeah, I wasn't. I watched those everything they were referencing when it came out, and as much as I was like, this is fine, but I didn't really see how it was its own thing. Now maybe it got better. It's my understanding people are still very obsessed with it. I'm not decrying Stranger Things, but I will not be referencing Stranger Things very hard in my Hell of a Summer review or elsewhere, because.
I've seen Finn Wolfhard act in a few films.
He's fine.
So I'm eager to hear what he did as a director.
What did you do, Finn Wolfhard? What did you do?
I am interested when actors begin to direct.
Yeah.
Just to see I know what their performances are like, but what kind of a creator are they? I'd like to see that.
Anytime someone makes the shift, whether it's actor turns director, writer turns director, cinematographer turns director, doesn't happen as often, but always cool when it does. Costume designer turned director, it's happened a few times.
There was Schumacher, wasn't he a costume
designer? Schumacher was costume
first?
Designer, yeah. And what's the name? Who directed the original Twilight?
Catherine Hardwick?
Catherine Hardwick.
Okay.
She was a costume designer, memory. So she was a production designer. One of those. I'm going to look that up. She deserves so much better than she got.
I remember Catherine Hardwick from her film 13, which she made in the early 2000s.
That was her big debut. Yeah, which was a big fucking deal when it came out.
Production designer. I think she worked on, like, The Terminator or something. Like, she's worked on some, like, notable films.
These are the questions.
Yeah, Catherine Hardwick. We're not reviewing any Catherine Hardwick films. We're just going to bat for her right now.
Yeah, no, she deserves a bigger career. Like, any male filmmaker who launched a billion-dollar franchise would be swimming in offers to this day.
Although, that certainly should be true of Twilight. And Twilight... Mm-hmm. I gave the films a bad review. I actually don't think they're very good. I think the scripts are really kind of insipid, but I don't blame
something right.
I don't blame Catherine Hardwick at all. She actually brought a lot of mood to that, and I think the two lead actors, you know, both Robert Pattinson and
Kristen Stewart.
Kristen Stewart,
you got it.
Are both incredible. They're like the most interesting actors of their generation. And I feel like they were directed to represent the characters from the books. Mm. And from what I understand, the characters from the books aren't very rich or interesting.
Okay. Catherine Hardwick was a production designer on Tapeheads with Tim Robbins.
Yeah.
I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka.
All right.
Brain Dead, the horror movie from 1990, not the Peter Jackson one.
The one with Bill Paxton.
Yeah. Freaked.
Oh, there you go. Oh, yeah.
Tombstone. Stop hitting things.
In fact, Catherine Hardwick is in Freaked.
Is she really?
There's a scene where a clown says, "I'll fart your weight." And he looks at a woman and says, I think you look like you weigh about 107. He holds a megaphone up to his butt and starts farting 107 farts. Yeah. The woman he's talking to is Catherine Hardwick.
Nice. She was also the production designer on the excellently production designed Tank Girl.
Okay.
Kings, Vanilla Sky. She had a great production design career.
Yeah, before she was even directing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, sadly, we're not talking about Catherine Hardwick.
We did, though.
We did.
Good for her.
We're going to be talking about Minecraft.
We are, and we're in a weird position this week because usually we try to see at least a couple of films together.
Yeah.
If not necessarily in the same space, and we at least both saw the same film. This week, no one saw the same movies.
No, I saw Minecraft, and I was just behind this week, so...
Yeah.
I'll be talking about Minecraft.
And I didn't see Minecraft.
I'll be listening to William review three other films.
But the thing with Minecraft...
I try to see at least a couple, and this was just a light week.
We had this little internal debate about, like, do we, like, save it and then, like, review, like, 20 movies next week? Or do we just keep the show going out consistently? If you have strong opinions, either way, would you rather us, like... wait and have to do this bi-weekly if we've only got a couple and we haven't all seen them, let us know. Or if you'd rather us produce the show on a regular basis so that the reviews come out in a more timely manner, we'd be curious to know. Yeah, so.
Do you like the marathon podcast where we review 9 films and they go on for 2.5 hours?
If you're a Patreon member at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, feel free to leave us a comment on this episode. You can also get this episode ad-free on Patreon. Or we're on social media at Critic Acclaim on Blue Sky. And we also have an email address. It's letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is your P.O. Box?
Yeah, send us a letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yes, and feel free to ask us questions, take us to task, whatever, and we might read your comments, your questions, your prompts on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. Anyway, let's get started, because a Minecraft movie was a monster. It did really well at box office.
And there was a little bit of doubt just because a lot of people found that to be such a trite idea, making a movie about Minecraft. Video game movies kind of have an uphill swim at the box office a lot of the time, unless it's doing, like, Super Mario Brothers.
I mean, we're getting to a point where video game movies are more consistently doing better, and at least in the case of Super Mario, I think it was the YouTube series Pitch Meeting. Described it as, we're going to play it safer than any movie has ever played it safe before. Because that's just not doing anything interesting with the material. We're just doing Mario. It's going to look like Mario.
As possible. Yeah. Most insipid plot we can think of with a Mario skin.
And honestly, aside from the fact that it's very pretty to look at, I found it to be incredibly boring. But I get why people liked it. Because if you paid to see a Mario movie, that's what you fucking got.
Yeah. And, we can't throw stones. I'm of a generation that grew up with toy commercial cartoon shows that were owned by Hasbro and put out by Hasbro.
G.I. Joe, GoBots, Transformers, Gem and the Hologram,
My Little Pony, Rainbow Bright, all of those were weren't based on toys. They were toys.
Yeah.
And then they decided to make these cartoon shows as a means to sell the toys.
Almost exclusively, yes.
It was, and... it's like the stories were an afterthought. The makers of these shows, they were trying to get them out as skillfully and as quickly as possible, but these weren't based on, like, rich mythologies or rich complex characters or even interesting premises.
Well, they knew the importance of getting kids invested in them, not just thinking this looks cool, but saying, no, here's this guy's name. Mm. Here's his backstory. There's something to wrap your head around so that instead of just thinking it looks cool.
I feel like a lot of the characters that my generation grew up, loving were based on, their color, their abilities, the weapons they held. Yeah. Only people of a certain age could tell you sort of the subtle character distinctions between the Ninja Turtles. They got richer over time just because it stuck around for so long.
And I think it got more ubiquitous over time. I think most people could tell you, like, which Ninja Turtle is the one with the orange mask. I think a lot of people can at least tell you that's Michelangelo. Yeah,
but I think a lot of little kids liked, the Ninja Turtles or the Power Rangers because of the color or the weapon they used. It wasn't a lot to do with their subtly individual personality.
I didn't say subtly individual. Yeah. I just said they have a character, even if it's a broad character, and it's like, I know that guy. That's the tough guy. That's the cowardly guy. That's the cool lady,
I feel like our generation lost out on a lot just because we weren't getting a lot of interesting art. But at the same time, We also grew up at a time of scheduled television, so a lot of older shows and classic cartoons were mixed in with some of that garbage, so we got classic Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
In between, you know, your Power Rangers.
And also, I'm gonna go to bat for the 80s and 90s a little, because although a lot of these were basically just toy commercials, no argument, they did
have... I am painting with a broad brush, I understand that.
Some of them were better than others, and I think there were a lot of writers and showrunners and actors who were hired to do these things who put in more effort than perhaps they really needed to, and did at least sometimes do something interesting. Whereas, and we've talked about this a lot when we do like 70s cartoons on Cancel Too Soon, 70s kids had it rough. This is what you had to watch on
Hanna-Barbera cartoon shows. Oh my god, so bad.
Like, no wonder y'all turned out so pissed off and are trying to like wreck the country. Like, oh my god. Have you ever seen Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kids? Like, yeah, dude, that was Transformers is better. I'm not gonna say it's great. It's better than that. It got steadily, and then the 90s cartoons actually got pretty good for a while.
Well, animators in the 90s, like at the end of the 80s, animators got so sick of those toy commercials.
Mm-hmm.
They at the time, they called it marquee value. We just call it IP these days. That they couldn't sell a cartoon unless it had a recognizable element to it.
Sure.
And it wasn't until the 90s that creator-driven animated shows really started to take off.
Mm-hmm.
And a really healthy animated underground started to sort of emerge.
Yeah.
You got your Mike Judge, your John Kay's, the South Park guys.
Not going to use the word healthy to describe John Kay.
John Kay is an utter creep. You can look up the things he did.
Yeah, just for clarity's sake. But he was a significant person in that
movement. Rather unfortunately, he also revolutionized animation in the 1990s. MTV started to have these showcases like Liquid Television. Spike and Mike started to have the Sick and Twisted stuff coming up.
And even on kids' television, we started having classier material. Like a lot of the Disney afternoon shows were produced. Batman the Animated Series, Gargoyles, Pirates of Dark Water. We started getting some good stuff.
Even in the mainstream, I feel like... 1990, Tiny Toon Adventures came out.
Right.
That was like a redux of the Looney Tunes, but I felt like it was so fourth wall breaking.
It had its own vibe.
Really self-aware of like where it stood in the pop firmament.
And that paved the way for Animaniacs and Pinky and the Brain.
Yeah, so the 90s, there's a lot more creativity going on than the Cartoon Network shows a little later. Space Ghost Coast to Coast is nestled right in the middle there.
Let's bring it back to focus. So the Minecraft movie.
I can't fault any kids for wanting to come see a Minecraft movie in droves.
It would be hypocritical to do so.
So I'm not going to say... I think kids do deserve better entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Just in general.
But, you know, I understand Hollywood is going to Hollywood. And that these kind of cynical enterprises come along every once in a while.
I'm not gonna, but listen, as much as I can roll my eyes at this corporate-driven culture in which we live and how much these types of exploitable intellectual property tends to drive the Hollywood economy. Again, it would be hypocritical of me to complain too much. And also, I'm okay with kids having their own thing. Like, I don't have to fully appreciate it the way they do. It'd be nice if I could. I certainly try. I get the appeal of Five Nights at Freddy. I don't know the lore. I'm not going to get as invested in it by nature. And that's okay. I'm in my 40s. And I'm actually kind of happy in a weird way that Minecraft is doing so well. Because nostalgia has been monetized and weaponized to the exclusion of so much else for so long that in a weird, almost perverse way, that Minecraft and Five Nights at Freddy's movies are, like, doing so well, and these are, like, very contemporary, at least relatively contemporary, intellectual IP. These are not stuff we've had since the 80s. That at least feels like we're moving forward a little bit. At least we're giving the new kids what they want, instead of pretending they still love G.I. Joe.
It's a new generation that is being exploited. But yeah, at the very least, it's not my generation trying to rehash our shit for them.
Yeah, like, trying to keep it alive.
Your Ghostbusters afterlife nonsense, that kind of stuff.
Which, and again, I love Ghostbusters. Apparently, people aren't that into it. I'm okay with putting it to bed or maybe just doing a TV series or something.
Or just come up with something something new.
That's my point. Yeah. Like, I'm okay with it. Like, we had a run. So, not everything has to last forever. We will introduce it to future generations. It's part of the canon, or at the very least something we can have access to, and that's good. But, yeah, let the kids have their new shit. Actually, let me start here. What the fuck is Minecraft?
Okay.
Because I've never played... I've seen Minecraft.
Okay.
And I get the gist, but what is... Because you have a son who really likes Minecraft.
I have a son. He's about to turn 10, so I'm right in the thick of it right now. He really loves Minecraft is... I think it came out in 2011. It's pretty...
I'll double check that.
As far as I'm concerned, that's relatively new as video games go.
In the long scheme.
It was put out by a Swedish company called Mojang Studios, and...
2011.
And if you're not, you're probably familiar with it just because the iconography is bled into the popular culture. You've seen the merch around.
Lots of blocks, kind of low res.
It's meant to look a little low res, but it is a 3D environment, and there's no levels. There's no quest. It's just like a sandbox you play in. And the rules are you can sort of dig through the ground, find elements to mine. And then you have magical crafting tables where you can put together the many, many elements in the game in certain configurations and craft things like swords or weapons.
Houses,
mountains, tunnels, whatever you want. You just build and build and build and there's no goal other than the one you set for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Is there conflict?
There is, because there are days and nights move in 20-minute cycles within Minecraft, and at night there are monsters.
Ah.
So you have to build a shelter for at least long enough to keep like skeletons and zombies away.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And
a little scary.
This is why you can mine and craft things like armor and swords. And as the game has continued on, there have been like bigger, stranger things. Some monsters called
Stranger Things again.
And Endermen and Ender Dragons, and there's other like dimensions you can travel into, which more or less just open up the elements that you can mine and craft out of.
The same basic premise has remained the same.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. It is the single best-selling game of all time.
Is it really now?
If you wanted to combine every different release of Tetris as one, then Tetris has it beat.
Right, but this is the individual, like the first Minecraft game.
Yeah.
Is the best-selling video game of all time.
The single best-selling video game of all time.
All right. I'm curious what else is up there.
some other newer games are also up there, games that I haven't played.
Best-selling video games.
So,
Minecraft, 350 million units.
Yeah.
The next closest one is Grand Theft Auto 5, and that's only at 210.
Yeah.
So, oh my god, and then you go way the fuck down, and the third one is 82 million with Wii Sports, and that's only because it came with the Wii.
Yeah, and the Wii was a pretty big deal.
It was. What the hell is Ark Survival Evolved?
Yeah, see...
Nobody tells me nothing.
Well, we're...
It's like the fourth highest grossing game ever. What the...
I was obsessed with video games from around age 7 to around age 17, and then when I went away to college, I kind of fell out, just because I was too busy doing college stuff. And then I didn't have the money or the wherewithal to keep up with newer video games. So I kind of went back in with the Wii, because that was really popular, and now we have a Nintendo Switch. But yeah, I was never, like, obsessed with video games beyond my youth. In my youth, I was... obsessed with nothing but video games. So you ask me about anything that came out from like 85 to 96, I got you covered.
Tell me about...
like Mega Man 3. Yeah. I can tell you all about Mega Man 3.
But tell me about the Power Glove. Was it so bad?
I only got to use a Power Glove once. The Power Glove was a controller you wore like a glove. It was shaped like a glove, and you bent your fingers to... Like, there's no buttons. You just bend your fingers.
There were buttons, but they were, like, on the wrist, so you could, like, press start and stuff.
And it was motion-controlled. You set up these sensors on your TV screen so you can move your hand around and control. And this was, like, back in the late 80s, so it was revolutionary at the time.
Mm-hmm.
My son is obsessed with Minecraft. Every kid his age is obsessed with Minecraft.
Mm.
I think it's that open-ended thing that a lot of people like. A big reason why Minecraft took off in popularity, though, was because of YouTube.
Mm.
Video game play videos are a gigantic percentage of what's on YouTube.
Yeah.
And
I think that's really interesting.
And people could play Minecraft and just sort of talk about it.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, that's interesting. Oh, I can cut down this. Oh, look what I'm building.
Mm-hmm.
They could play that for like 3 hours, cut it into 10-minute chunks, put those 10-minute chunks on YouTube, and make a living that way. way.
I know. It's really interesting to me, I think, because, you know, we think of video games often as kind of a, you know, sometimes there's a two-player or four-player game, but usually it's kind of a solitary activity. You're kind of at home. And I feel like all of these Let's Play videos have made video game consumption a little bit more like movies. Like, we're all watching this together. It's a shared experience.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. Like, it's more of a community because of that.
My son would prefer to watch hours and hours of video game videos with YouTubers who just sort of describe their experiences as they're playing than a feature film. He doesn't like scripts or TV shows that have stories and characters. He likes hearing just people sort of yammer about the games they're playing. And he likes Minecraft. He likes Among Us is another big one for him.
Sure. Fun
game. That's a big hit. He's very fond of Roblox. That's another big one for this generation.
A lot of block-oriented games.
Yeah, well, the free open-end thing. The idea of, like, starting at a low level and working your way through a game, getting more powerful and fighting an end boss. He doesn't even like those types of games. Things that have, like, that, and that's the type of game I grew up with.
Sure.
So because Minecraft is really open-ended and because it's, got its popularity through people just sort of talking about it, how the hell do you make a movie out of that? Because movies, fictional movies, tend to follow typical kind of Hollywood melodramatic beats.
Yeah, narrative structure, forward momentum,
I would like you to tell me what the story of a Minecraft movie is, and I'll tell you how right you are.
Okay, so here's all I know from seeing, like, a trailer.
Okay.
Okay? One or more kids and, I don't know, their uncle, babysitter, dad, guardian, Jason Momoa, right?
Okay.
Get sucked into Minecraft, right? Like the video game, like Jumanji style.
Yeah, they're inside the video game.
Okay, right. Well, not exactly Jumanji style, because they're not, like, inhabiting the rock, but they just get pulled into the game, like the old Dungeons & Dragons cartoon.
That's right.
Okay. And then they do Minecraft stuff.
Okay.
And then leave.
But tell me, once they're... You got that part right. They get sucked into the Minecraft world.
Okay.
What's the story once they get there? What do they have to do?
Well, I assume the monsters play into it in some way.
There's a monster.
So, like, they gotta like, prevent the monster from doing bad things.
Like pitch it to me. Like, you don't know what this is, but you gotta pitch me a story.
Okay, so, a couple of kids and their drunk uncle get pulled into a video game. And the kids know the video game, the drunk uncle doesn't. The drunkle. They have to learn how to do these skills for real in a very Last Starfighter-y kind of way, in order to stop monsters from building a thing within Minecraft that could lead them to the real world.
Not quite.
Okay.
That's trite.
I'm just remembering other similar films.
So, the Jason Momoa character is not their drunk uncle. Okay. He's just, he owns a used video game shop in a small town in Idaho.
Is he drunk?
No, he's not drunk.
Is he stoned?
He's not stoned either. This is a PG-rated film. You can't have...
Well, it can be stoned up, can't. Hey, rough, no, hang on.
Rough
hang
details
on.
Quite like that.
Hang on, the Pharrell Lego movie had a scene in Snoop Dogg's office where it was, like, a bunch of haze. And then there was, like, one... When we cut back to, like, the reverse shot, there was, like, one, like, roadie or something who had, like, an aerosol can that was, like, PG spray.
That's cute.
That was cute. That was a good way around it, yeah.
There are two kids who are, through movie contrivance, have lost their parents.
Okay.
Their father is...
And honestly, that's careless. To lose one parent is a tragedy. To lose two is carelessness. Thank you, Oscar Wilde.
The father is never mentioned. Their mother has passed away recently, and they have to move to a small...
That'll come back in the sequel.
They have to move, and the older sister is still pretty young. She's like maybe 19 or 20. And they have been forced to take a job in a little small town in Idaho that is obsessed with potato chips. This is done by Jared Hess, who also did Napoleon Dynamite,
which also
takes place in this quirky small town in Idaho.
Mm-hmm. He did Nacho Libre as well.
Yeah, and that explains
small town movie.
Well, it's another. It's
Jack Black film.
Jack Black. They want Jack Black to play a Mexican.
Good Edward Rubin.
Yeah, thank you. There's a young boy's and. All of the, like, Napoleon Dynamite-like details are in this small town. Like, someone of them makes a tater tot pizza. There's a llama in the background. These are details from... And it has the same kind of weird early 2000s quirky indie comedy vibe before we even get to anything Minecrafty.
Got it.
So the Jason Momoa character, he owns this used video game shop. In 1989, he was a big video game champion, but now he's fallen on hard times.
Didn't The Wizard come out in 1989?
It did. Sadly, they don't make quite a strong connection. He's not.
That would be fun, though. He's the bad kid
from The Wizard.
Yeah.
Or he's the bad kid.
He's the bad kid with the power glove. Like,
oh, that'd be great. Lucas.
I used to love the power glove. It was so bad.
He's fallen on hard times. He purchases a warehouse at an auction, thinking that there's going to be something like a valuable video game he can sell in there, but it's faked out. But he does find a glowing widget. Like a magical box, and a little box that goes in. Takes him back to his shop. He befriends Henry, the young boy who comes through. He gets in trouble at school because he builds a rocket that blows up.
Okay.
Jennifer Coolidge.
Wait, he builds a rocket that blows up?
Yeah, he builds a rocket at school.
Oh, okay. Like a rocket launcher, like a astronomy tool.
It's actually a jetpack, and he straps it onto his class skeleton. Blows up. He gets in a lot of trouble. He's an outcast. He can relate to Jason Momoa now. If we had never gotten to the Minecraft stuff, the video game world, this would have been a fine, quirky indie comedy.
Okay.
Which I think speaks to the unexpected amount of personality that this movie has. It's not a lot, but it has some.
Yeah.
Which is shocking for a project this cynical.
You know,
We got Jennifer Coolidge and Jason Momoa is really overacting a lot, and it takes place in this weird, quirky little town.
I mean,
it's strange enough. Yeah. That we could have lived here. It's not so cliched that it just feels like a boring setup for stuff.
That intrigues me because if you think about a lot of the other video game adaptations, a lot of them that have specific characters and storylines, like look at the Uncharted movie.
I didn't see that one.
But like, just as an example, that's based on like a very Indiana Jones knockoff-y kind of vibe. And the games are fun, don't get me wrong. But to produce them as a movie, you end up feeling like a knockoff of a knockoff because it just feels like we're doing Indiana Jones, but not the good knockoff, and like we're doing the cheaper, like not as good version. But like with a sandbox, you could get a director to give it some distinct personality. So that's potentially exciting. So that works out well,
It works out well. Okay. The young boy puts those two crystals in Jason Momoa's shop together. That opens up a portal in a mine across town.
Okay. Crafty. Now,
as it turns out, there was a very long introduction before all of this where we got to meet the Jack Black character, Steve.
Okay.
Steve is one of the only known quantities from Minecraft, one of the only characters that has any names.
Okay.
And he doesn't have, like, an adventure or anything, but he is a recognizable figure that the characters can play as.
Okay.
There's Steve and there's Alex. Those are the two characters.
Okay.
Jack Black is Steve, you see.
Okay.
He found his way into the Minecraft world many years before and moved in there. He found us, and everything in the Minecraft world...
Are the kids aware that Minecraft is a video game?
No, it's not a video game in this universe.
Okay, just to be clear. Okay.
So they're not going into the video game. They're going into a realm that looks like Minecraft.
Which is the plot of Super Mario.
It is. That is true.
Yeah.
In the Minecraft world, like in the game, everything is like square and blocky. The sun is square in the sky. The days and nights only last 20 minutes. Sadly, they never address what that does for like cultivating crops or sleep cycles.
Yeah, your internal clock's going to get fucked.
He's the only human being... I like that they cast someone like Jack Black, who's kind of a round fellow.
It's always nice to see him.
He's the roundest thing in a square world. I thought that was really kind of cute.
It's cute, I think.
There are people in this universe, but they kind of like mutter, and they all have like square skulls, and they don't really communicate like people.
Do the square skulls look... Because I'm thinking like what they did with like MODOK in Ant-Man Quantumania, where they just like stretched his head out and it looked absolutely horrifying and cheap.
No, they look like they do in the game, but with like realistic flesh tones.
I'm not sure so that's a good thing.
They're made of realistic things, but they just happen to be square or cubic.
I'm just saying, that sounds like a Cenobite.
It looks a little odd.
Yeah, oh no, you don't want to... Oh god, the scariest member of the Order of the Gash is Blockhead. Ooh... Makes Butterball look like a walk in the park.
I will mine things out of your body.
Yes.
And they just mutter. There's
mine and crafting.
There's
invisible.
Even a subplot where one of those things wanders. It does wander into the real world, and Jennifer Coolidge hits it with her car and then takes it on a date. and, like, tries to romance this, like, square-headed monstrosity. That's kind of cute.
Yeah. Yeah. All
right. So, yeah, they find their way. It's the two kids. It's Jason Momoa, and it's the realtor character who's just sort of, like, along for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
And she's played by Danielle Brooks, Academy Award nominee. Danielle Brooks from Color Danielle Purple.
Yeah, she's amazing in Color Purple.
Yeah, she has almost nothing to do in this movie. She's just along.
Get that paycheck.
She's like the... I want to say she's like the normal character, but everybody's a little off in this movie, which I appreciate.
No, but seriously, though, like, you're going to get paid for this. You take that and take the clout and do something better later.
They meet up with Steve, and Steve takes on the role, and I think this is the reason why a lot of kids are really eager to see this film. Steve takes on the role that every kid has had to take on with their parents at some point, and that he has to explain what Minecraft is to these characters. He has to explain the rules, but he's excited about it. Yeah, you can mine this tree, and you cut a tree in half, but the top half stays up in the air, and you take this little miniature block, and then you can kind of, like, flick your wrists through the air and just build things spontaneously like you're clicking a mouse.
Mm.
And here's the way this works, and this is what an ender pearl is, and this is how you eat chicken in this universe. And he goes through step-by-step explaining everything about how the Minecraft universe works, and it's all taken from the game.
I just had this huge swell of pity for my grandfather when I tried to explain Super Mario World. Him, like, no, you understand, I jump on this dinosaur, and the dinosaur eats things, and sometimes it poops out eggs, and it's really good. Mm-hmm. And then I jump on this thing, and it's a superstar. And I'm like, he had the patience...
Yeah,
he had no idea what he was talking about. He had the patience of a saint. He was a sweet man.
I think I've told this story before, but I was once taken to a Dave Brubeck concert by my grandmother.
Okay.
She knew Dave Brubeck. She was one of his classmates.
Wow.
So I'm at a... But I was like maybe 10 or 11 years old.
Okay, a little young.
So I don't know about Dave Brubeck. I don't really care about jazz. But I do care about the Nintendo Power magazine they let me take into the concert hall. And I was so excited about at the time it was about to come out, Super Mario Brothers 3.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, it's like which was revealed for the first time in the movie, The Wizard.
The Wizard. It's like 89 or 90. It's like, Grandma, look at this magazine. And she's like looking at it, it's like, Super Mario Bros. Super Mario Brothers 3. Yeah, it's really great. I'm trying to explain it to her. She's there to see Dave Brubeck.
Dave Brubeck is here.
It's like, okay, Dave Brubeck is here. Okay.
Did Dave Brubeck find Super Mario Brothers interesting? Was Dave Brubeck really into it?
I think if I had talked to Dave Brubeck that night, I probably would have shown him my Nintendo
Power. I guarantee you he would have. But here's the thing. I'm not entirely sure Dave Brubeck wouldn't have been fascinated. Like, they play video games. Musicians play video games. I played I played Sega Saturn with Scott Weiland from Stone Temple Pilots once in a Good Guys store.
I can assure you 100% that Dave Brubeck never touched a Nintendo in his life.
I don't know, man. No.
So the story from there on is complete hokum. Jack Black lives in what he calls the overworld, but there is also a netherworld, which is you have to go through a portal to get there.
Is Alex like leading all the monsters?
Alex is not part of the movie.
Sequel.
But there are an army of piglins, these square pig monsters that live in the netherworld, and they're ruled by Golgotha, which is sort of like very biblical sounding villain name.
Mm.
Let me look up the character's name. She's played by
Lucifer.
She's played by Rachel Hand as a Kiwi actress.
Okay.
See, Jason Momoa, Rachel House is her name. Malgosha is the name of the pig over mistress.
Mm.
And I
love that Rachel House has a good career. She kind of came from out of nowhere, and everyone's like, no, she should be in everything.
She should be
in everything. She's great.
And Jared Hess also did that film Gentleman Broncos with Jemaine Clement.
Yeah.
Another Kiwi comedian. He's also in this. He has a bit role.
She was great in Hunt for the Wilder People, which nobody talks about enough, by the way. That movie is wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. But the piglins, they have... They're not creative, you see. They've only mined their worlds looking for gold, and they've mined it bare, so now they want to invade the overworld and steal its resources and look for more gold.
So they're Americans.
They're greedy.
So they're Americans.
They're bad because they're greedy.
So they're Americans.
You can read that into it if you like.
And I just did.
even though they're led by a Kiwi, but all right.
I mean.
And she wants a magical widget that she can plug into her staff and shoot a beam into the sky. And
ooh, sky beam. Now I'm grounded.
You get the sky beam.
Now I know where back. I'm putting it. Yeah. Yes. What color is the sky beam?
It's purple this time. It's not blue, surprisingly.
How great for Asexual Appreciation Day, the day that we're recording this. This is great.
And the kids learn how to mine, and there's a subplot with Jason Momoa who wants diamonds because this is a mine world and because he's broke. The story is just functional. This is written by there's five credited screenwriters. I'm sure there's at least 20
others.
Always
amazes me when there are like five credited screenwriters for something that's merely functional. You'd think that would mean they're trying to make it interesting, because anyone can just do an outline.
Yeah, I don't know why they feel like they need these entire teams of screenwriters to pare it down to something as cliched as possible.
Like, back when he was just getting started, I interviewed James Gunn, like around the time he was writing the first Scooby-Doo, and he had also it was well known that I don't think he was credited, but he did a polish on the 13 Ghosts remake.
Okay.
And I asked him about, what did you do on 13 Ghosts? And he was like, honestly, they only paid me to beef up Matthew Lillard's dialogue.
Okay.
Yeah. That's it. I just made his dialogue more interesting. That was the whole gig. So sometimes that's all there is to it. Patton Oswalt had a whole bit about how sometimes you're just writing ADR to
like jokes that throw into unfunny scenes. Yeah. Just shout jokes from off the...
Oh,
off
no, camera. I fell on some butterscotch! Yeah, that was the Patton Oswalt spin.
Sometimes you can tell when it happens and it works anyway. I remember watching, of all things, the Goosebumps movie.
Good movie!
And there was...
Also Jack Black.
There was a scene where a mummy wandered up to something that exploded, and the mummy was propelled, miles across town, and we got to see it land in a field.
Yeah.
When something like that happens, especially in a kid's movie, you have to add dialogue after it happens to establish that they haven't died.
Yeah, everything's fine.
So sometimes they'll even say, I'm okay. I'm all right.
If you look at Ang Lee's Hulk, there's a scene where he, throws a tank a mile, and then you can hear the ADR, we're fine! Are you really?
We're okay. What I liked about the Goosebumps movies, we saw the mummy, arc across town. It's, flaming through the sky.
Yeah.
Lands miles away in a field, and it goes, oof! And then just yells, I'm not okay!
That's almost a meta joke.
It's a little bit of a meta joke for that one. So many screenwriters are required, I think, to kind of pull personality out of it.
Trying to make
it as functional as possible. Yeah. It's like, okay, somebody made it a little too quirky or a little too strange, or somebody added this plot element we want to keep, but now it doesn't work with this
play
one.
So it this, play safer. Play it safer.
Pull it back. Pull it back. Make it work. Make it work. It's like one screenwriter can do that. But anyway, so all of the adventure stuff, who cares? The story is irrelevant. What the film has that kind of makes it okay a movie?
I love how you sound vaguely ashamed of that.
Because it actually is okay. Startled to say that the Minecraft movie, is kind of okay. I like the personality of these people. I like how weird it got in certain portions. Not super unusual. We're not dealing with somebody who's so strange that it's going to off-put a mass audience.
Right,
but
it's not Tetsuo the Minecraft Man.
I would love to see Shinya Tsukamoto do a Minecraft movie.
Right? Now you're into it. Now you're thinking. Corporate art is still made by artists, and sometimes it turns out okay.
There's this great story between the Jason Momoa character and the Jack Black character. They're at first trying to sort of show each other up and, get into a dick measuring contest, but they end up being kind of friends by the end. There's even
like three amigos, and then you're friends.
Well, there is that moment. It's like, did we just become friends? Yeah, I think we did. And they're shaking hands and they end up singing songs together at the end. It's like,
oh, that's cute.
That's kind of a good, healthy, positive relationship between these masculine characters.
Can Jason Momoa sing?
No, but Jack Black can.
Oh, no, I know Jack Black can. That's what
Jason Momoa is just mimes guitar. And okay. Jack Black sings.
Fair enough.
They didn't push them quite so far that they have a romance. That would have been nice.
Does Jack Black do any original music?
He does. He sings a song at the end.
Okay. Is it good?
But yeah.
Good.
It's a good metal song.
Yeah, he was denied his Oscar nomination for Peaches.
That's true. I am frustrated that these are the least creative kinds of movies possible, these IP movies. that often sell the idea of creativity as one of their themes.
It is ironic, isn't it?
The Lego movie was the same way.
Yeah. Lego movie was good, though, to be fair.
Yeah, but...
You know, it can be done, but... There is something inherently ironic about, here are these very specific parameters in which you're allowed to be creative.
And we're going to have the theme be creativity.
And being creative, or expressiveness, your creativity makes us money is also fundamentally part of it as well.
It was also part of the emoji movie, for God's sake. How do you express yourself? These things are used to express your emotions. But this is like the tritest shit.
Yeah, well...
it's terrible.
And again, there's degrees. Like, some of the movies we described are very good. Some of them are just okay. So, some of them are shit.
So, you know? I feel like a Minecraft
Emoji movie literally has a character named Poop in it. I mean, come on.
Voiced by
Patrick Stewart. He got that paycheck.
So, yeah, a Minecraft movie is like... has some personality in spite of everything.
Right.
Which, I was happy it didn't suck.
Nice. Yeah, I love it when things suck that aren't supposed to suck.
Now, I was unsure if this was going to succeed because even in my son's like YouTube Minecraft watching community, like all these videos he was watching, everyone was mocking this thing.
Yeah, the trailer came out and I felt like there were a lot of gamers who were just thought it was like, it looked terrible.
This is absurd. This looks terrible. The preview was being remixed in like video game videos in a derisive kind of a way.
Yeah.
And it comes out and, like, all those YouTubers are going to eat their words.
I think there's two factors at play in there. And one of which is just the kids movie factor, which is most kids are going because their parents are taking them. So if you sell a ticket to one kid, you're probably selling at least one other ticket to a parent, maybe two or more.
So these things tend to make... Kid movies make a lot of money.
They tend to inflate a bit, especially considering there's not always a lot of competition. Mm. There usually aren't a ton of big kids movies in theaters at the same time.
Yeah.
So they tend to kind of have that playing field pretty level to themselves. But the other thing, and I think this is really important to remember... Online buzz, positive or negative, about movies is actually from a very small percentage of the movie-going marketplace.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can say things like, oh, yeah, everyone online is talking about how great this movie is going to be. Everyone's super stoked about it. And we love it, too. But if you're not online, you might not have even heard Snakes on a Plane was coming out.
Yeah.
And it just didn't do that great.
Well, and I feel like,
or you might say that, like, even like, oh, that's why... Like, this movie did so bad because the online discourse. Most audiences who were primed to see Snow White probably aren't on those Reddit feeds. They're probably just going about their business. Most people who go to movies aren't big movie people. They're very casual about it. They see maybe 10 movies a year.
I think, and this is true of, like, trying to gauge certain fandoms.
Yeah.
As it so happens, Deadpool had a lot of fans.
Yeah.
Like, even before Ryan Reynolds played him in that Wolverine movie.
Yeah, oh no, the first Deadpool movie was a big hit.
And
you know, didn't make $1 billion, but it did really well.
That Wolverine movie is bad for many, many reasons.
I agree.
The fact that they changed Deadpool didn't bother me at all. Mm. Maybe because I'm not a big diehard Deadpool fan.
Mm.
But evidently there was a big stink. There were enough Deadpool fans for them to try again in a couple of years. Same actor, but now a more comics accurate version of the character, and that one was a big hit. At the same time, I think there were a lot of people who really liked the character of Harley Quinn, sort of a female counterpart to the Joker in Batman comics.
Mm.
They tried multiple times to make movies with Harley Quinn. And none of them were really a big hit.
And some of them were good, too. That's the thing. So,
but good or bad, people just weren't interested in the character.
That's my point, though. Yeah. Quality doesn't even enter into it. Sometimes there's just a less interest from the... And again, when you're making a movie where the standard for a success is $1 billion...
Right.
You're not going to make that money off the diehard fans. You're going to make that money off of the casuals.
Hmm.
You know, there's a reason why... Ghostbusters movies all tap out at around $230 million, no matter who makes them and who stars in them.
Mm.
That's the audience for that right now. I know it feels like it should be bigger. It's not. Star Trek movies don't make $1 billion. The audience just isn't that big. You're not getting the casuals as much as you would think. Minecraft, nothing but casuals.
Mm.
I mean, that's a lie. But you know what I mean? There's a ton of casual interest in Minecraft. So it makes sense that it would be huge. It's no guarantee that it would be huge, but apparently people were excited about it.
Mm.
And apparently it's not a bad movie, which is, that's nice, you know.
I mean, it's, again, I don't want to oversell it.
No, it is no classic. But you enjoyed yourself, and that's saying something, isn't it? I enjoyed myself,
and that's all I can, yeah, that's all I can really say.
You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
All right. Well, speaking of enjoy yourself while watching an IP movie, we talked last week a lot about the public domain slasher phenomenon, which if you missed that week, the gist of it is this. We're now at a point where every year, new material enters the public domain. Books, music, movies, cartoons, comics, etc. But we're reaching a point where the stuff that is becoming public domain is the stuff that is still noteworthy and making money.
Yeah.
So, like, Popeye is a thing. Winnie the Pooh went in the public domain. And because now you get to play with these things, and there are limitations on what is available. Not every aspect of the character might be public domain all at once. Some elements of it are trademarked, and so that's a different rule. But generally speaking, yeah, you can make a Winnie the Pooh movie now. And because no one really has the Disney money to do the $100 million version of that, a lot of people were doing these like really down and dirty, almost just dark jokes of movies where, hey, what if Winnie the Pooh was a slasher movie villain?
Yeah.
Sounds like a silly idea. Sounds like a college humor sketch. It is, basically. But we're going to do it full length.
We have a third of $1 million. We can do it for that much.
And the novelty alone will get us over the finish line of profitability. And
which turned out to be true for that Winnie the Pooh movie.
Winnie the Pooh
was made for so little money that it didn't need a lot to become a hit.
No, just you know, a couple of raised eyebrows and idle curiosity, and it did well, and it's got its own cinematic universe now.
Well, we'll see how that works.
Well, but the point is, they're so cheap, they don't have to make a lot of money to keep that going, is my point. So they got, like, Peter Pan going on now, and so on and so forth. Last week you did Popeye the Slayer Man. You said it wasn't very good. And here's the thing. Winnie the Pooh wasn't very good either. In fact, Winnie the Pooh, at least the first one, I didn't say the second, is almost impressively incompetent. Like, you're just like, you know, you really didn't have to try, but you could have tried harder than this.
Could have done something.
This, at the very least, you could have, like, had slightly better screenplay and acting. Like, what are we... Ugh, it's terrible. So the bar is really, really low for these. And I haven't seen a lot. I haven't seen all of them. And I'm sure there's going to be more. But of the ones I've seen, Screamboat is the best.
Okay.
Screamboat is the one where, and again, I'm not going to oversell it. I'm not going to say it's a great movie. I'm not going to say it's a new horror classic. But there's a scene in Boogie Nights where Burt Reynolds plays the director of 70s pornographic films who dreams of making pornographic films that people actually become emotionally invested in. Mm. And his editor in the film is played by the late, great con man slash magician Ricky Jay.
Yes.
Sometimes actor. And they're editing this new James Bond knockoff movie that they've done.
Yeah. The Johnny Wadd films.
Yeah, and Ricky Jay turns to Burt Reynolds and he says, it's a real film, Jack. And again, that's a low bar to clear, but Screamboat is a real film. Like, it's got characters, it's got some wit to it, it's got some not great visual effects. It's filmed on a real boat. That, again, low bar, but I didn't expect them to clear it. I was seriously... And not just any boat.
Filming a boat on dry dock from low angles
It's filmed on a ferry in New York.
Okay.
Apparently, I think it was Pete Davidson and one other comedian, for whatever reason, bought a decommissioned ferry.
Okay.
And even Pete Davidson was like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever bought. I don't know why I did that. But they've got it, and apparently they sometimes lease it out for filming. So the plot of the movie is this. So Steamboat Willie is the cartoon this is based on. That's, I think to date, that's the only Mickey Mouse cartoon that's public domain so far. If you've never seen it, it's an animated classic. Mickey Mouse is introduced as the captain of a steamboat on a river. He's whistling, he's having a good time. His boss is like a giant cat played by a character named Pete.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, a bit mean. Mickey's girlfriend, Minnie, comes along for the ride, and they sing, and they warp reality around them in a very early Disney kind of way. There's a little bit of menace, and then everything turns out fine. Not a lot to work with. At the beginning of Screamboat, a couple of people are doing repairs on the Staten Island Ferry, which, you know, they keep it going for forever. It's been like a hodgepodge of old parts, new parts. And they open up, like, a hatch that no one's opened up in, like, 50 years. And, like, a rat man climbs out.
Okay.
And he's not the size of a mouse. He's, like, the size of, I don't know, like a 5-year-old kid or something. Very tiny, but, so like you know, like Chucky size. All
right.
Well, he kills them because that's what he does. He's a killer rat Mickey Mouse ears. The Screamboat monster, Screamboat Willie, is played by... You know him, you love him, David Howard Thornton from Terrifier.
He's Art the Clown.
Yeah, and he's you know, he's a talented physical performer, does a lot of mime.
I love those Terrifier movies, man.
A lot of Screamboat is just David Howard Thornton, and again, he's really tiny in the plot, so a lot of the time he's in front of a green screen in order to sell that. It looks fake, but because
David
Howard
Thornton is actually a tall guy.
Yeah, no, he's tiny. He's like cartoon size, so like, you know, he's playing it up real big, and he's just playing in front of a green screen, and a lot of the movie is just him reacting to things off camera, like, ooh, he doesn't say anything. He goes, ha-ha, but he doesn't really say anything. But, like, the equivalent, since I can't show you, is like, ooh, that's gotta hurt. Or, like, when he sees, like, the lady protagonist, like, you can, like, he falls in love with me, like, ooh, like, he wants to get her flowers and things instead of murder her. But it's the middle of the night. It's on the Staten Island Ferry. It is a hodgepodge collection of weirdos. There's a young woman who is an aspiring fashion designer. And she is being... I think she was working at a restaurant. And a bunch of drunk women who are having a birthday party are just sort of following her in a weird way. Not like stalking her. It's just like, hey, we're all going to party with this chick. In like a socially uncomfortable way. And all of these women are named after or designed after Disney princesses. So, like, there's one that's, like, got Ariel's basic color scheme and hair going. Like, it's all parodic. It's not literal. Right, that's their vibe. And they will be murdered.
They're going after Disney in general.
Yeah, they're just...
If you're making a slasher film with Steamboat Willie, then you ought to.
I mean, you should make the most of it, really. So we meet them, we meet the people who are working on the boat, a lot of them have, like, one personality trait. It's New York, so there's a lot of, like, incidental people who are very specific, like, hey, here's a guy in a cowboy hat wearing nothing but tidy whities and playing a guitar. We will never get to know him, but we will recognize him throughout the film. Like, oh, it's that guy. I know that guy. He was there.
Mm.
Boom.
So again, you can throw personality into a cheap movie.
You can. And
that's all you should do.
And this movie has a ton of personality. Is it all great filmmaking? No. But it's got a ton of personality. It was directed by Stephen LaMorte, which is a great name for a horror filmmaker. I hope that's his real name, but if not, kudos for doing it. He recently directed, and I meant to see this because I heard it was pretty good, but I never got around to it, The Mean One, which was like the slasher version of The Grinch.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, The Grinch isn't in public domain, so they were playing with fire on that one, but I guess they got away with it. So he's got a shtick, I guess. We meet a cavalcade of characters. They're all played by actors who, if they're not great, they're trying. Like, they're putting in some effort. They're trying to put some energy. It's an energetic film, which I couldn't say for that Winnie the Pooh film.
Okay, yeah.
You know, like, everyone... It's got that sort of, like, lo-fi, early Sam Raimi kind of gee whiz, we can make a movie kind of mentality to it, which is pretty good. Like, it's not nearly as crafty as that. It's not nearly as... you know, visually ingenious as that, but no one's just sticking a camera down and then getting two pieces of coverage and ending the scene. Like, we're actually trying to entertain you here. And they do a good job. There's a lot of gore. There's a scene with a severed bit of guy business that is certainly very memorable. And then and then leads to another scene with the same severed bit of guy business, in a less predictable way. And I was like, oh, good callback, I guess. Like, I'm enough of a horror fan that I can appreciate, you know, a good horror, quote-unquote, gag. Mm. But also, like, yeah, I also didn't need that. But okay, yeah, you know what? You're trying to get notice. You're trying to get attention here. You're trying to make sure that we don't nod off in the theater.
Yeah.
You succeeded.
Well, that's the old Herschel Gordon Lewis philosophy,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, you don't have a lot of money, but you can buy blood.
Yeah.
Blood is cheap. Just put a lot and mm-hmm. be creative and gross with it, and you'll get noticed.
Like, they clearly spent the money on the boat and a decently sized cast. And not everyone gets a lot to do or is particularly good in it, but a lot of people worked on it and presumably got paid, I hope.
Yeah.
And the makeup on David Howard Thornton is pretty good.
Okay.
Not going to win an Oscar or anything like that, but you get away with it. Like, it's pretty good monster making.
In that Popeye movie, you could tell it was a mask, especially in certain
places. No, he's clearly been in the makeup chair for a while.
Okay.
Like, he looks the part. He looks like an evil mascot, but, like, he's got that, like, actual...
What was the budget on this cast.
I don't know, actually. I would be surprised if it was a lot, but they clearly had some money.
Because with Popeye, you know, I'm not disparaging it because of this, but you could tell it was really cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't...
Yeah.
That doesn't factor into a film's quality.
And there really aren't, like, Tyler Posey's in it, and I know he's, like, been in stuff, but... And I know David Howard Thornton is a rising star in the horror community, but I would also be surprised if they're making $1 million a film.
Yeah.
You know, so I honestly don't know what the budget was, but... It doesn't look like they were shooting around their budget too much.
I looked up the financials just mm-hmm. now, just
sure.
right here on the online.
You got it?
It was made for $15,000.
It looks way better than $15,000.
Nothing.
They got a sweet... I don't know who... Do they know Pete Davidson? Like, I don't know how they got the sweetheart deal on that boat. Because that is production design. That is... That's production value. You know, you get one thing that looks impressive on film, and you film the shit out of it. And 99% of the movie takes place on that boat, and they're clearly filming all over it. It looks like a real film. Like, they had real money. There's like an animated flashback sequence that's like the origin of the evil version of Mickey, which is pretty well animated, actually. It looks pretty good. It's very similar to the Winnie the Pooh thing. Like, he was an innocent creature who got kind of betrayed by humanity and left all alone. And I guess if you leave a cute critter, like, all alone for long enough, they become serial killers.
They turn feral, yeah.
Like, I don't know. Is that a thing? That, like, if you just... Anyone, no matter what, if, like, you break their heart and, like, you leave them long enough, they will just... Not just, like, you know, darken their soul or anything like that, or like make them really bitter or angry or even like yearning for revenge, but become a homicidal maniac.
Okay, this can't possibly... So you're describing Screamboat as having as having some pretty good effects. They're filming it really well. It has some pretty slick production values. It was made for $15,000.
To a degree.
Okay.
To a degree. Let's not go nuts. As these things go, I've seen a hell of a lot. It looks a hell of a lot more expensive than Winnie the Pooh.
Popeye the Slayer Man evidently was made for $20 million, which that does not track at all.
That seems very strange. I would be very surprised if that was true, but I didn't see it. Maybe there was some hidden production value there that I don't
maybe
know.
Maybe so, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. But in any case, yeah, Screamboat, here's the deal. It's a real film. It's not about much, and I'm kind of waiting for someone to do something with all these great public domain characters that means something. Like, it's you don't have to break the mold. You don't have to do the greatest thing ever, but, like, surely you have something more to say than what if they killed people.
Well, I don't think that's what we're interested in here. It's like, oh, or any of these slasher movies.
I
think the whole point is these slasher movies aren't being made with horror characters. Is my point. You know, it's not like, you know, when Dracula enters the public domain, I'm going to do a Dracula horror movie. Wait a minute.
Right.
Dracula's a horror character.
Well, Dracula is in public domain, but fair enough, yes.
Just to cite an example.
Yeah.
I think...
So the contrast is the end-all, be-all of the gag.
No. The juxtaposition, that's also an old gag. It can work sometimes.
Sure.
Something innocent turns into a murderer. We do it all the time.
Sure.
Filmmakers do it all the time. The point here is that a lot of these public domain characters were previously owned rather famously by a known corporation.
Right.
for Popeye, it was the comics. It was, you know, the studios that owned Popeye.
Yeah.
For Winnie the Pooh and Steamboat Willie specifically, those are owned by the Disney Corporation.
Right.
And they are... So these movies are being made not just to explore the character in sort of a fun juxtaposition. What if they committed violence? These are meant to be a rebuke to the ownership and the kid-friendly image of the Disney company specifically.
I understand that, and I agree that there is some value in that inherently. I also think that's the kind of thing you can come across in, like, one sketch.
You can do it in one sketch, like, but the fact that they've made a whole movie of it is kind of the point. The fact that the movie exists is the joke unto itself.
I realize
if that. The movie is good on top of that, then that's a bonus.
My point is this. I think there is a law of diminishing returns on how effective that's going to be, and we're going to hit a point where it's like, okay, so now Dagwood is a serial killer. Oh no, he put Mr. Dithers in his sandwich. Ah, how gross. Like, eventually that's going to lose its power. And I'm waiting for someone to, and again, ride the wave. Enjoy it while it lasts. If you can make him as good as Screamboat, again, not amazing, but perfectly watchable, fun, gory horror movie. If you're a horror fan, you will probably enjoy this one more than the others that I've seen. But if this is all we've got, this is going to get tiresome.
It's going to get tiresome, but I appreciate the movement. I appreciate the instincts that people have to just grab something that was previously corporate-owned and squeaky clean, snatching it away and kicking it into the dust immediately.
Yeah.
To just get it a little dirty.
Yeah.
And once that's out of our system, people can start doing more interesting things. Maybe actually bother putting some money behind it, coming up with, you know, like, creative new ideas for Winnie the Pooh.
Right.
But until that happens, I have him chew skulls. That's fine.
Yeah, yeah. Now, like I said, I'm fine with it in theory. It's a little punk rock in theory. It's a little thin, and the more of these I see, the less jazzed I am by simply doing that premise. So, but Screamboat is the best one that I've seen so far, and it's the only one that I would I've seen so far that I would recommend. Maybe not a lot. But there's definitely an audience for this, and this is certainly going to hit some people hard, and they're going to have a good time. Next up, we have a really fucking good movie.
Okay.
I think this might be one of the best movies I've seen so far this year. It's only a few months in, but still, I really responded very well to this. It's called The Luckiest Man in America.
I know this story.
Yeah, it stars Paul Walter Hauser as a man named Michael Larson. And Michael Larson has an interesting little niche in television history. There was a game show in the early 80s, might have started in the 70s, there was a game show called Press Your Luck. And it was a combination trivia show and also game of random chance. And the idea was...
That's the one with the whammies. You remember the whammies.
If you've ever heard this phrase, no whammies, no whammies! Mm. The idea was this. You answer trivia questions, and based on how many trivia questions you got right, you got opportunities to press a button and stop, like, a series of squares that were being lit up in kind of a random order.
It was like a roulette wheel.
A roulette wheel, but you can control when it stops.
And there were a few no prizes that would take away your money, and those were the whammies. Yeah, these little red critters.
Yeah, it was like the mascot of the show was the whammy, and if you hit the whammy, you lose all the money. So the idea is you press your luck, you try your luck, you do what you can, and once you have a tidy amount of money, you don't want to risk hitting a whammy, so you just pass. All right. Well, Michael Larson went on Press Your Luck in 1984, and he won over $100,000, which is a lot now. In fact, that was the most money anyone had ever won on a game show in a single day, a record he held for like 30 years.
Yeah.
Like, or at least 25, I think. But, like, yeah, it's really, really astounding. And this is the story of the day he did that. It starts the day before. He auditions to be on Press Your Luck. The producer is played by the great David Strathairn. And he finds this guy. He's like an ice cream truck driver. He's kind of a sad sack. You know, Paul Walter Hauser has this kind of, like, oddball charm to him as a performer. He's really great. I think he's an amazing actor, actually. But the guy's like, listen, this is good television. You know, whether he wins or loses, this is the kind of guy you want to see in a game show. So we're going to put him on the show, even though he's a little sketchy and, like, he actually wasn't supposed to audition today. He just sort of showed up, and when we called someone's name, he just raised his hand. But David Strathairn's like, look, he's enthusiastic, he's naive. We'll put him on, he'll win money or he won't, and we'll be done. It'll be a good episode. He goes to the show the next day. and the rest of the movie takes place all in one day. It has this incredibly dreamlike stream of consciousness energy to it.
Aww.
Where everything's like really heightened, like the Press Your Luck board kind of like looms over him, almost like a computer in a Black Mirror episode or something. Like it's really weirdly intense. And then he goes on the show and he starts, presses the button, wins money. And he said, do you want to take that money and pass, or do you want to keep going? No, I'm going to keep going. And he keeps winning over and over and over and over again, never hitting a whammy. And then the movie is all about everyone in the studio trying to figure out what the fuck is going on. Is he cheating? How is he cheating? Who is this guy? You need to figure out who this guy is. We can't stop recording in case it's real. But like, they're freaking out. And they honestly think this guy could like bankrupt the studio if he keeps pressing his luck, if he really is this lucky. Or if he's cheating, how the fuck is he doing it? And I won't tell you how, in case you don't know the story. I'll leave like some bit of mystery.
It's, okay, yeah,
it's not so well known that okay, everyone knows it.
Pretty well known piece of TV history.
It's pretty well known piece of TV history. Suffice it to say, I would argue he earned the money. Yeah, I would argue he actually earned the. We're just gonna leave it there.
Okay.
The point is, he essentially broke the game.
Oh.
And this is all about. I guess there's a helicopter outside. Yeah. Hello. Goodbye. It's all about just the studio panicking. It's like, no, you don't understand. We want these peons to win a little money. We don't want them to actually succeed in their dreams. And there's something just wonderfully, almost Orwellian about their portrayal of the CBS network. About how, like, you know, we give you your fantasies within our parameters. You're not allowed to just make as much money as you can.
I've seen a documentary about these events.
Yeah, there's a couple of them, I think.
Yeah, there's just a short documentary. And the documentary is hilarious because they're treating it like it's this really, like it's a hard copy, current affair kind of like news program. And then you figured out how to game the system. It's really serious when it's just like this guy kind of gaming a game show.
Yeah.
But it also went into detail about how this was just one of many of Larson's schemes.
And he was a con artist.
He was involved in like Ponzi schemes and real estate schemes, and he tried to like bilk investors out of something to do with Walmart.
Like, it's abundantly clear even from the beginning of this movie, before you know all the details about this guy, that while he may be some kind of like underdog, he doesn't seem like a great guy. And I think Paul Walter Hauser is great casting for him because he can get you on his side and get you excited when, like, he's making this weird dream slash scheme of his happen. But also you realize there's something wrong with him.
Mm.
There's something incomplete about him. There's something sad about him. There's a void here.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much I actually support him and his endeavors. And Paul Walter Hauser is a master at keeping that going.
Well, here's the thing. I really admire con artists who con the big cheese.
Yeah. I don't mind when you do that.
When you bilk, if you're like running some sort of scheme to like steal credit card numbers from like poor people, and you're like conning people out of some kind of like gaming scam. Yeah, fuck you. That's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're like an individual who finds out ways to scam corporations out of money, good.
I can't be that mad.
I read a story just recently. I wish I knew a little bit more about the details, but evidently this guy figured out how to fake bills, like mail bills to people, and just in the hopes that they would find the bill, write a check, and mail it in, and he'd just get the money. He did this to Elon Musk.
Oh, no. Elon Musk.
He conned Elon Musk out of millions of dollars.
Fine.
Good. You did good,
I mean,
sir.
He's not even going to notice.
Yeah. Like, he was sending these bills out to, like, these rich idiots who just, they're just going to pay bills. They don't care. Fine. Let him make a living that way.
Like, again, it's all a matter of, are you punching upwards or punching downwards? Yeah. Like, if you look at, like, the movie The Beekeeper, the Jason Statham movie.
Yeah.
That's about, like, phone and internet scammers who, like, steal money from old people and, like, destroy their retirement until they might even take their own lives.
Mm.
And then there's, like, I don't know, this is not the perfect example, but then there's, like, you know, in Ocean's 11, Danny Ocean is stealing from a fucking casino.
Yeah.
Danny Ocean steals more money. The beekeeper guys are the ones who are evil. Like, again, if you can steal something from someone who either won't notice it's missing or deserves to have stuff taken from them karmically, you got me. And honestly, like, in this, again, in all the other contexts of Michael Larson's life, maybe not. In this exact moment, fuck CBS. Like, there's a lot of people working there, and I do appreciate that there are, like, people working there. There's, like, Maisie Williams plays, like, a PA or something, and she's talking about how, you know, you're going to get me fired. We're all going to get fired over this, and I'm not a millionaire. I don't have money. So there is, that is addressed. There are, like, other potential consequences for this thing, and that leads this level of real intensity to it. That's like, because again, when it takes place all in one day and everything's like taking place like during the episodes as they're recording them, it's just this real warped dreamlike. You never have like a panic dream where everything's moving too fast. That's kind of this movie. It's really funny. I got really invested in it. It's kind of wonderfully surreal. There's a great, I'm not going to tell you what the context is. There's a great scene with Johnny Knoxville.
Nice.
Playing a character, like not like just being Johnny Knoxville. That actually is like, I'm sure it didn't happen, but it's perfect. Whoever wrote that scene, genius. Absolutely the best way to play that moment. You did a fantastic job. I really do think this is a great movie.
Okay.
I think if you know about it, cool. If you don't know about it, you're going to find it surprising. That's why I didn't tell you everything about it. But
I like that you said he's like not a completely honest guy. Like he's not depicted that way.
Yeah, like he's definitely he's got sympathetic qualities, but also like he's doing something wrong. But you're not sure how wrong it is. What is the extent of how bad he is? Is he just a scam artist, or is there something worse at play here? And they do a really good job with it. Paul Walter Hauser is fantastic in it. The whole cast is really, really good. The production design is fantastic. The editing is great. I got really swept up in this movie. I passed my Billy Elliot test, which I think I mentioned before. Like and this is not something you can do with every movie.
You didn't get to see my quizzical head cocking.
No, I've mentioned this before. Yeah. I might have called it something else before, but and you cannot. This is a test that cannot be applied to every movie because it will endanger your health. And I'm setting up this in a weird way. When I was in college, I had pulled a 36-hour day during finals week, or midterms, or whatever the fuck it was. And I was fucking exhausted, and I was miserable, and I was walking home, and if you've ever been to UCLA, UCLA is this bizarre landscaping wonder where literally everywhere you go is uphill. I don't know how they did it. Going to my apartment and coming back from my apartment, all uphill, both directions. I don't know how they did it. So I'm miserable, I'm tired, my feet hurt, and I'm walking past this like student union thing, and they're showing for free, and it was the new movie at the time, Billy Elliot. And I was like, fuck it. So I go into Billy Elliot. I figure if I fall asleep, I fall asleep.
Okay.
And I've been up for 36 hours, and Billy Elliot was so fucking good. Not like it's the greatest movie ever, anything. It's just really well-made, involving movie that I didn't fall asleep when I had been up for over a day. If a movie can keep your attention when you are fucking exhausted and your eyes don't even droop once, that must be a pretty good movie. There's something about that movie that's grabbing you. And Luckiest Man in the World is one of those. It really grabbed me. Good. I think it's great. I hope more people see it. It feels like the sort of thing that like should have come out towards the end of the year. Maybe Oscar stuff is unlikely, but it would give you that element of prestige. Like, maybe it's worth it.
Yeah.
And I feel like dumping it in April in, like, very limited releases and doing a lot of favors. But it's really good. And I hope you see it, because it's really, really good. All right. And then the last movie I am reviewing is a film called Hell of a Summer. Great name for a slasher movie, by the way.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a great movie, but a great name for a slasher movie. Hell of a Summer is a summer camp slasher movie, co-directed by Finn Wolfhard and Billy Brick, who had a small role in Ghostbusters Afterlife, which Finn Wolfhard was in as well. He's done some other acting work as well.
It's probably how they met, yeah.
I don't know. I guess they met in Kensington Market, which is a small neighborhood in Toronto, apparently. So maybe they're just local boys.
Okay.
Anyway. Hell of a Summer is pretty standard slasher movie fare to start with. There's, like many summer camp slasher movies, the kids aren't there yet. It's all about, like, the counselor setting up. Because once you have all those kids there, it gets into a weird tone. I do appreciate that the one Friday the 13th movie where the kids actually were at the camp, Friday the 13th Part 6, has a scene where Jason is stalking around and kids are hiding underneath their beds and one kid turns to another kid and said, "So what did you want to be when you grew up?" And it's such a good line. It's so great. anyway, yeah, everyone's fucking dying. And the main character is a character named Jason. he is played by an actor named Fred Hechinger. Who was in 8th grade.
Oh, yeah.
He was in The Woman in the Window. He was in the Fear Street movies, so he's got a bit of a pedigree. And okay. I guess he was on the first season of White Lotus, so which I didn't watch. So, he loves summer camp. He's 24.
Okay.
And he had, like, an internship to, like, some kind of law firm or something. Like, his mom pulled some strings. And he quit that. Because the people who ran the summer camp he used to go to every year said, "Hey, listen, you were always a good camp counselor. Could you come in? We need some extra people this year." Okay. So he dropped an actual career to do this. All because right. He loves it so much. He is a dork. Nothing wrong with that, but that's his character. He's a huge dork. He's socially awkward. He's super invested in camp. And the gag is, none of the other counselors are invested in camp.
Yeah.
The people who run the camp are killed in the opening scene by a killer in a devil mask. Hell of a summer. A note is left behind saying, "We'll be back in a day, you guys get ready," and over the course of the film, people start dying and are killed by a guy in a devil mask. Jason is just trying to get everyone on board, trying to get everyone excited, trying to get all kumbaya, and the rest of the cast is full of people who are a-holes, a lot of them. Some of them are in love with a girl. Or is she in love with him as well? I don't know. My friend's jealous. He's like Ken Marino in Wet Hot American Summer. He wants to be like the horny cool guy, but he doesn't have the skills to do that, so he comes across as more pathetic than anyone else.
Yeah.
There's the one theater kid who is the cartoon theater kid. There's the one girl who is a vegan, and that's it. There's the one girl who is, like, the goth chick, and she, like, has a Ouija board that may be important later. A lot of characters with very specific individual traits. Anyway, eventually, Jason finds a dead body, freaks out, tells everyone about it, and all of these people are kind of such horrible people that instead of... Like, the first thing they do is try to leave. Makes sense. But their cars have all been sabotaged, so they're stuck. They're also terrible people that they turn on each other very quickly, and like halfway through the movie, they all decide that Jason must be the killer, and now everyone's trying to kill him. And that's pretty funny.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good kind of cynical tone to it.
And he's not, well, he's not. Maybe there's a twist, but yeah.
There's based on the first scene.
I imagine they presented that he's not actually the killer.
In the first scene, we see people die at the summer camp, and in the second scene, we see this guy's mom driving him to the summer camp.
Okay.
If he is in on it, it's a group thing.
Okay.
But he certainly couldn't be just him.
Yeah.
So we know that much. And there is a reveal. It's not hugely surprising, but I've seen slasher movies hide it worse.
Okay.
The thing is that the gag is that they're all just kind of terrible people. Mm-hmm. And they handle it in terrible people ways. And that's cute. Honestly, there's a couple of characters who I really, like, got invested in, and I like, that guy's an a-hole, but I think he's got a good heart underneath it, so I hope he makes it out, you know? Like, kind of the a-hole that, like, you know, you're 19 and you're trying too hard, but eventually you're going to grow up and realize you can put all that away and just be a good person, that kind of thing. Like, there's a little bit of depth in, like, two of the characters. The kills are honestly not very noteworthy.
Just people getting killed.
Like, some of them are fine. None of them stand out. There's no, like, one memorable death, like Kevin Bacon getting the arrow in his throat in Friday the 13th, or that one bit in, what was that movie that came out last year? The very pastoral slasher movie.
Oh, what was it called? In a Violent Nature.
In a Violent Nature, yeah. Which is a great movie. I love that movie, actually. But there's one kill in that movie that is, holy shit, never saw that one before. Ooh. Like, if you remember nothing else about that film, you will remember that one kill. Like, yeah. Woo! There's nothing that inventive here. It's basically just, can we make a laconic, funny, kind of bitter little slasher comedy? And you can. The pacing needs to pick the fuck up. That's the biggest problem with it. It really does feel like we're just trying to get to 88 minutes, wherever the fuck long it is. There's a lot of dead space. There's a lot of bit where we're like, okay, and then these two characters are going to talk. Great. Are they funny? Kinda? Sometimes?
I mean, do they at least have, like, interesting things to say?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes they do. Like, it's not a wash. It's not a wash. And there's certainly some charm to it. I can see the personality behind it, and I can appreciate what they were going for. There are moments when it works really good.
Hmm.
But overall, the overall presentation is weirdly slowly paced, and it feels like maybe this was a really good short that shouldn't have been a feature.
It's sounding to me like you were talking about that can-do attitude of, like, indie filmmakers who have no money, but they're going to make a slasher movie anyway.
Yeah.
I remember a lot of people who talk about sort of modern blockbusters as homages to, like, older B-movies.
A lot of them are,
A lot of them are. And they just have a gigantic budget.
Yeah.
They say, oh, this is supposed to feel like an old B-movie. Well, no, it doesn't, because there's actually things happening in your movie.
Right.
You watch old B-movies, and a lot of them are slow and dull and terrible.
That's the part people forget
about fun old movies.
Right.
Really not fun for a lot of it.
I remember when Grindhouse came out, and that was like that double feature. Robert Rodriguez did one, Tarantino did one, and the idea was supposed to feel like a double feature at a Grindhouse movie theater in the 70s.
Yeah.
Robert Rodriguez made the type of movie he would make now, but in a slightly 70s-ish kind of way. And it's very fast-paced and very wild and gory, and every scene is interesting and weird shit happens, and it's really fun to watch.
Mm.
Tarantino made a 70s movie in which there's two fucking exciting scenes, and they are admittedly really fucking exciting, and then the rest of it is kind of boring dialogue.
Yeah, it's just people talking about stuff.
And I know some people are like, oh, Planet Terror was better. Maybe? But Death Proof is the one that's accurate.
That's what those 70s movies were like.
There's a lot of waiting around in those movies.
That
actually, like, leave out, like, a couple, of, like, it's that takes place in the present day, but you could remove a couple of references and you'd never know. Like, take that out, that's a 70s movie. Rodriguez made the 70s movie that you remember because you're cutting out all the bad parts. Hell of a Summer is a lot of the boring parts. And I think, and you know what? I think if this movie had been made in the 80s, it would have a small cult.
Yeah.
You know, and that would be fine.
Mm.
Now, I don't see it making a huge impact. I assume Finn Wolfhard has some fans who will see it, and I assume they're going to get some entertainment out of it.
Yeah.
But it is not great. But I will say this. Their first feature, they have a personality. They have some ideas. Now, if they could just get some energy, like, just pick up, like, really, you know, film takes place over a period of time. That sounds redundant, but it's true. Like, you can pick up a book, and you can pick and put it down again anytime. Movies, especially if you're watching them in a theater, you're supposed to watch them from beginning to end, and that means they have to keep your attention for the entire running time. And there are a variety of different ways to do this, and this is one of the things we talk about when we talk about pacing. If it's all excitement all the time, even that gets boring. You need to go up and down a little bit. This is a movie where the only real problem with it is the pacing.
Hmm.
And it's just, I kind of want to just give the footage to an editing class and just be like, hey, can you do better?
Hmm.
That would be fun. That was actually something we did in my editing class. They found, like, a TV movie, and they gave us, like, all of the coverage for, like, two scenes.
Yeah.
And just say, you do it.
Hmm.
Go nuts. See what you can do with this material. There's only so much. We only have 10 setups. The scene is 2 minutes long. And then it was a great bit where, like, when we were done, it was like, okay, great, you edited this 2-minute TV movie scene, and maybe you did good, maybe you didn't. Problem is that we sold some extra commercials, so now I have to cut out 30 seconds.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, and that's a real thing. Yeah, that's a real thing. You might just, oh, all of a sudden it's running a little long. You got to cut 30 seconds. You got to cut 10 seconds. You got to cut whatever. And it's like, how? I don't know, man, but it's a TV movie on network television. it has to fit these specific slots between the commercials. And that was fun.
Yeah.
So I would love to, like, give someone just, like, a movie, especially a movie that didn't turn out perfect, and just, that's your project. Edit it.
Yeah. Fix that one.
Make it a thing. See what you can do with it. I'd love to see it. So, like, yeah, it's, the editing isn't great, the pacing isn't great, but it's cute, and I'm mostly, I was mostly amused.
Okay.
All right. So on that note, it's time to review movies on our critically acclaimed scale. It's the movie review roundup. We review movies on a scale of C- to C+. C- is a below average movie. These are movies that we just generally don't recommend, or maybe we think they're terrible. A C is an average movie. These are movies that are just okay, you know, mixed bag, maybe only for one audience, not for anyone else. And then a C+ is an above average movie. This is a movie we think is really good, maybe even great, and we recommend it wholeheartedly. On that note, Hell of a Summer. Very low C. Like, okay. Right on the cusp of C-. But I'm going to give it a little... Just, there's enough moments, there's a few characters I liked enough to make it, like, if you're a horror movie fan, if you're a slasher movie fan, might be worth it.
Yeah.
But if you're not, this is not the best example of a slasher comedy.
Got it.
Let's see. The Luckiest Man in America, C+. Wonderful film. Not at all what I expected. Like, I knew the story, didn't play out the way I thought it would. Impressively done film. And Paul Walker Hauser is particularly good. Actually, the whole cast is sparkling. It's great. Screamboat, a high C.
All right.
It's never quite good enough to justify, like, a full-throated recommendation. But, you know, if these kinds of slash movies have any interest or any appeal to you, this is the one to see.
Yeah.
This one's actually having fun with it. It's got a lot of energy. The pacing is good throughout. The kills are memorable. It doesn't have a lot to say about Steamboat Willie, but it's still a fun take on it. And there's a couple of really fun, weird bits that I thought was really, really amusing. And then finally, a Minecraft movie.
Minecraft movie is going to be a C.
Okay.
I mean, it's no classic. But for a film that I and everyone else kind of expected to suck because it's so cynical and such a strange idea to start with, it's shocking how average it is. And again, how much personality it has.
All right. Well, cool, man.
Yeah.
I think that's great. All right. That is it for Critically Acclaimed. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back next week with reviews of other films. Whitney, what's coming out this week?
We're going to be seeing Drop, the really interesting looking thrillers coming out.
From the director of Happy Death Day, so I'm interested. He's got a good vibe.
There's The Amateur, that Rami Malek film is coming out. It's sort of a revenge action thriller. There's a new film from Alex Garland is coming out next week, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, he co-directed it.
Co-directed a film called Warfare, which I think is connected to Civil War.
Okay.
The film he did Civil War in a way, like tangentially, but we'll find out.
I'm curious. There's a new action movie starring Viola Davis called G20.
Yeah.
I'll be reviewing that. And also there's a new Western called Gunslingers. And presumably other stuff as well.
There's a lot coming on.
There's a lot coming on. Hey, thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being a subscriber. Please subscribe if you haven't already. If you want to head on over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, you can hear all of our episodes ad-free. Sometimes when we're able to, we release them early. We also have polls for future episodes of things. We have exclusive material. We are very eager to get back into some of those projects. It's been a really rough year, but I think we're finally seeing a light at the end of the tunnel. A huge shout-out to our patrons. You've been incredibly supportive of us throughout all of these years, and we couldn't do this without you, nor would we want to. So thank you for all your support. It really means the world to us. If you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode, did we get something wrong about Minecraft? Did you love Hell of a Summer? Like, tell us what you think about anything. Ask us questions, give us prompts, whatever you want. We'll fill the time with your words and our response to those words. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Send us a physical letter, postcard, whatever you like, to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yes! And we're on social media at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William DeBiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
And never forget, everyone is a critic. I don't know why I said it like that.
To the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?